Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. This week we are talking to a senior writer at Andscape and an American Mosaic Journalism Prize recipient. We're talking about his new book, The Movement Made Us, A Father, A Son, and the Legacy of a Freedom Ride. His name is David Dennis Jr. He put this book together with his father, who is an absolute legend of the civil rights movement, named Dave Dennis. And I can't wait to speak to you all about it. I can't wait to speak to David about it. I mean, the book is like no other civil rights history I've ever read. I've also got some choice words about the change of strategy and the push for Brittany Griner's freedom, Just Stand Up and Just Sit Down awards, and more. But first, let's talk to David Dennis Jr. Talk to us first, please, about who your father was, who your father is, and how this book came about.
Yeah, so my dad, Dave Dennis Sr., is, you know, I guess what mostly known for being one of the freedom riders who took the bus from Alabama to Jackson, Mississippi. He would go on to be heavily involved in the civil rights movement, one of the sort of premier architects of the 1964 Freedom Summer. He was, you know, in Corps through Mississippi, dear friends with Medgar Evers and Goodman Cheney and Schwerner, and delivered an extremely powerful eulogy at James Cheney's funeral that sort of helped change the course of the movement in 1964. And now he's my dad, so he's a pretty good guy. It's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, I got so many questions. I mean, first and foremost about, you know, that moment where he spoke at Cheney's funeral and really played a role in shifting some of the political terrain of the Black freedom struggle. And I wanted to ask you, how familiar were you growing up with his history? How familiar were you with your father's past? How familiar were you with the movement itself and the politics of the movement growing up? Because I think it's probably worth explaining to folks, like, you know, you're what, you're 33, 34 years old? Is that right, David?
36. I'll take 33, 34, though.
Okay. So you know, you've got this gap period between when your father made this speech and when you were born. And can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I knew my dad's stories in sort of broad strokes. You know, I knew sort of these episodic tales that he told and not really the larger picture of what the context of his stories. You know, I'm not a historian. I didn't know, I don't know tons of deep cuts about the movement, you know? And so when he's telling me these stories, I didn't really have the chronology in my head as he's telling it to me, you know. You know, I knew Freedom Ride was 61, Freedom Summer 64, you know, things like that. But I wasn't deeply vested in the, I won't say deeply vested, but I wasn't sort of just deeply knowledgeable about the ins and outs of the movement. And I'm honestly still, now, I wouldn't consider myself any sort of civil rights historian at all still. I know a lot about my dad's time and the things surrounding him and, you know, some of the sort of larger political things that were happening at the time. But I sort of really wanted a real insular story. Like, I wanted to tell the story from, you know, the perspective of somebody that was so far deep in the trenches that, you know, there's almost no time to sort of absorb the larger national picture. So this book taught me a lot. Like, my dad, like, putting my dad's stories in a chronology taught me a lot. I had to do a lot of reading on what was going on. And so I did learn a ton. about the movement through this process.
Mm. Now, what's interesting is that, you know, you write the book in his voice.
Mm.
And I could see making a decision to write the book in the third person, for example, mm-hmm. as, you know, more straight bio. Was that decision difficult? Was that decision obvious? And was it, I don't know what the word to use, was it therapeutic to actually do the book in your father's voice?
Yeah, so it was, that was a decision from the very beginning. I was just like, always wanted, I was going to do it in his voice, just because I wanted it to be, I wanted to put you there, you know, I wanted to put you right there and make you feel what was going on. And I think the first person is really the best way to do that. And I also think there's a meta commentary in there in the fact that, you know, me at 36 or, you know, 33, if anybody wants to print, you know, at my age, writing from the perspective of, writing 80, you know, year olds' memories of being 20, and the fact that you can't tell really whose thoughts are whose at some points, you know, when, you know, and I think that in itself is an indictment of, you know, the lack of progress that this country has made. The fact that I'm in 2020, when a lot of this is written, 2020, 2021, writing things about race in America that my dad felt in 1961 and that people still feel today, and that the voices can be interchangeable. So I think I wanted to put a lot of that in there also.
Mm. And was it therapeutic to do this book? Was it, I mean, something that was almost healing with regards to you and your dad?
Yeah, it was therapeutic for us, for sure. For dad and I, you know, there are also a few letters in the book that are written to him. About our relationship and about how the movement impacted our relationship. And, you know, Dad and I were in a good, really good place. Obviously, it takes us to be in a good place to even start this process. Mm-hmm. We were in a really good place, but it was a very sort of unspoken good place, which I think a lot of dads and sons, especially Black dads and sons, can relate to, where you just sort of get to this, this equilibrium where you love each other and, you know, you don't worry about fixing a lot of things, it's fine, you know? And so, you know, us having these conversations, me writing these letters to him and us having, you know, grappling with it, put us in a totally different place that we sort of didn't think was possible, where we've spoken the things that we need to say to each other. So that part was very therapeutic. Now, writing and spending so much of this time essentially feeling like as my dad, you know,
mm-hmm.
and going back there, was sort of like I don't know if it would be therapeutic, but I know that, you know, now I feel like I knew Medgar Evers, and especially Medgar Evers and Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, which were two of the people who I did not get to meet. You know, I met a lot of the other folks who were in the book. And, you know, James Chaney and Mickey Schwerner are also people who, like, I feel like I know now, you know, in a weird way.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they're the things that were done to them, that they, you know, the killings of Evers and, you know, Chaney and Schwerner especially are really hard, a lot harder for me to cope with now than they were before.
What was something you learned about your father that you didn't know before putting this book together?
I think the thing that I learned is that I did not have, like I said, I didn't have an understanding of the chronology of all of this stuff, right? Like, this book was originally going to be short stories, because I don't, you know, biographies, for me, reading and writing biographies that have downtime are sort of difficult for me, you know, like if there's something that happens in, you know, 1 year and then the next big thing happens 2 years later, then you have to mm-hmm. write about all that in between time, you know, and sometimes it can get a little tedious sometimes in books if you don't do it the right way. Right. And so I was sort of like, I wanted to do short stories. So I want to skip all that stuff. I wanted to skip my dad's downtime. Right. Like the time where mm-hmm. I was, he was like sort of, just filing paperwork and, you know, like organizing and that stuff. But what I learned was that there was no downtime. Like this book ends up being pretty almost like a straightforward memoir that doesn't have any gaps in it because there was just constant stuff happening and overlapping and happen at the same time, or one weekend this happens, the next weekend this happens, and it just does not stop, you know? So that was the part that was really sort of, you know, eye-opening for me to understand exactly just how constant the barrage of, you know, actions and trauma and activity was going on for him and his peers.
Now, I want to ask you a few more questions about the writing process, because I do feel like this is a very unique kind of book. You know, a son writing the experiences of his father, and his father playing such a pivotal role in the defining struggle of the 20th century. But if you could explain to us a little history about the significance of your father's politics, particularly his speech at James Chaney's funeral, and what that helped facilitate in the movement and why it was so important.
Yeah, so Goodman Chaney, Schwerner were, you know, sort of long story short, were murdered, assassinated, lynched, however you want to say it, in Neshoba County, Mississippi, in 1964, leading into the Freedom Summer, which was a project where, you know, hundreds of volunteers, young kids, most, you know, a lot of them white from around the country, were coming down to Mississippi to help get black folks registered to vote and you know, help set up a challenge to the Democratic National Convention to show that this was an, you know, it was basically an illegitimate election that they were running because they were disenfranchising a lot of black folks in Mississippi. And so what a lot of folks in the movement knew was that this would be a dangerous activity for a lot of these white kids. They'd been trained, but, you know, it's still, it's dangerous. Like, you know, there's a lot of attention. They're going into these sort of backwoods areas that are not, you know, that you can easily get lost in. And so what happened is that when Goodman Chaney and Schwerner were down there earlier to investigate a church bombing and beating, they went missing. They went missing for more than a month. And when their bodies were found, well, let me back up. They were missing for more than a month, and my dad was supposed to be in the car with them. That's a very important fact, is that they came to meet him in Jackson. He was going to go down with them, but he had bronchitis, just happened to have bronchitis. And they said, it was sort of nonchalant, just hang out. You know, we got it. It's not going to be a problem. So they find the bodies, and Dad delivers this painful, passionate eulogy at James Chaney's funeral. And what it does is, you know, CORE at the time wanted him to have this sort of peaceful speech, right? This kumbaya, we shall overcome, we'll persevere type of speech. And he just did not do that because it was too much for him. But what the speech did is that it brought so much attention to the pain, the death, the struggle that the folks in Mississippi were going through, that it really, you know, allowed, you know, it created a safer environment, actually, because there was so much attention now on these kids coming down to Mississippi. It also, you know, brought the country's eyes on what was going on and helped, you know, bring a lot of attention to when they eventually did challenge at the Democratic National Convention.
You know, I don't want to ask you to answer a question for your dad, but given that you just wrote a book in his voice, I think it's appropriate. You know, the movement, clearly, when you read the book, the movement, you know, it gave so much to your dad, but it also took a lot from him as well. What advice do you think he would have to, like, young generation of activists, people wrestling with the next steps in the Black Lives Matter movement, people wrestling with questions of self-care and struggle, the urgency of the moment while needing to understand this is a long-term fight? What advice do you think he would give?
I think his advice is that everybody has a role to play, and you don't need to feel compelled to die or to be martyred or to sacrifice yourself to be part of the movement. That was his, you know, he felt that was his calling. You know, like he felt as though he should be somebody who should be sacrificed as part of the movement. He was willing to die for the movement. But that should not necessarily be everybody's feeling going into something. You know, if that's how you feel, that's, you know, that's how you feel. But it doesn't make you less of, you know, a pivotal figure if you want to preserve yourself. You know, if you trust other people to sort of do certain things, like everybody has a role to play. And if you just do something, you know, if you just do one little thing, then it's welcome and it's necessary. And then if you feel compelled to do more, keep going. And, you know, I think we need a sort of to push people to do things, but also understand that, you know, sort of have faith that people are doing sort of the best they can.
Mm. Now, you've been you went to Davidson College. You've been a successful writer about culture and politics. Is having a father with the history of a Dave Dennis, has that been, would you describe that more as blessing, burden, or a combination of both?
I would never say it was a burden, because he never pushed me to, you know, do this sort of stuff. He's always said that he's felt, again, like I will just find my way in it, you know, doing in the way that I write, or if I decide, like he's always sort of trusted me to, you know, do what I feel is right. And he's also, you know, mostly concerned me being a good dad and husband and being a better husband than he was. And that sort of a form of movement work in itself, right, is how we take care of our families, how we provide for our families and do well for the people who love us closely. So that's always been the thing that he's been, his main focus has been. But I've never felt, I felt compelled. I felt, you know, I have felt a legacy. I have felt, you know, pride whenever we do things that change the course of certain moments or events. But I've never, you know, I haven't really, I mean, I think at the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement, beginning of Ferguson, I was sort of conflicted about how to go about movement work and my place in that. But, you know, I've sort of settled into a sort of confidence and sort of a understanding that I'm doing something.
You know, one of the parts of the book I loved, and one of the reasons why I think like Nation magazine readers should check it out and read it, and scholars and all the rest of it, is that it reminded me of books like Charles Payne's I've Got the Light of Freedom, or the parts of Taylor Branch's Parting the Waters that don't deal with King but deal with the actual grassroots of how the movement developed. Was that a goal going into it, to provide that kind of grassroots, hey, it's not just Dr. King, Rosa Parks, that this is at the actual protein of the movement, people like Dave Dennis and the work that they did? Was that a goal going in?
Yeah, I mean, and not only was it a goal, like my dad was not going to do a book otherwise, you know. He has always wanted to defer to and highlight the people who are not, whose names will never get mentioned in other places, you know. Branch's book, Pardon the Waters, those were extremely influential. Local People was extremely influential. Coming of Age in Mississippi, and Moody's book, extremely influential about how to do that. And, you know, that was integral. That was one of the goals. Like, I think Dad's, you know, you reading a book about Dad and myself is a Trojan horse for you to learn about folks you would have never heard of. You know, Victoria Gray, Annie Devine, C.O. Chin, Amzie Moore, I mean, Herbert Lee, we can go on. And I hope that those people shine through in the book as much as you know, my dad.
It is remarkable when you're reading the book and you hear descriptions of people as being like brilliant public speakers and incredible organizers, people risking their lives. And you just think like, wow, like, where are these folks now? Where are their kids now? Like, what? Like, is the legacy question shines throughout the book, and it's very powerful, man. It really is.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, that's you know, I think I want people to come away from this, you know, heartened by me and Dad's relationship and where we are now. But also, I want you to think about the people who did not live to have that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, James Chaney's daughter was born, I think, like the same week that he was killed, or I think something like that. And, you know, Medgar Evers had, you know, kids, and, you know, Herbert Lee and all these folks like who have children who should have been around to have this sort of relationship that Dad and I have grown into. And they didn't, because they were killed before they had the chance, or folks who, you know, lived through it, but were so consumed or so overcome by the trauma that they could not make things right with their children. Like, they're like, I want you to think about what has been gained by me and my dad, but what could have been by a lot of other people in their families.
You know, we're obviously living in very difficult times these days. Do you see this book as perhaps also being something about, you know, 2022 going forward, and what it takes to build a kind of resistance movement against forces that want to tear us backwards?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of this book was written summer 2020, you know, in the time of George Floyd. So a lot of this is written then, and a lot of this was thinking about what the message is. And I think there are some very practical, you know, I didn't want to do, neither of us wanted to do, you know, old civil rights veteran wags his fingers at the young kids and tells them how to get this done, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What we did want to do is show you what he did, right? And one of the important things that Dad and all those folks, a lot of the folks back then did, is they understood that movements were already happening on the local grassroots level wherever they went, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's important to know now, is that there is a resistance movement in every single corner of this country. You know, there were people in Ferguson before, mm-hmm. Before, you know, Mike Brown. There were people in Minneapolis before George Floyd. There were people in Florida before Trayvon. There were people already there. And the best thing you can do is show up and say, how can I support, instead of showing up and saying, this is my thing now, you know?
Mm.
And I think that was a real practical thing we wanted to make sure that we put in there.
Mm. So what's your dad think of the book?
He likes it, you know. He's happy with it, you know. I have my book anxiety, so I called him this week to double check. I was like, you still like the book, you know? And so he's happy with it, you know. And I think mostly he's happy that we, like we said before, we highlighted the people who we wanted to highlight.
Dang. So what do you do for an encore after this? I mean, it feels like writing the book of one's father's life is like a crowning achievement. Like, do you have any plans for a follow-up?
I have none. Like, so this was going to be, I had a plan back when I thought writing books was easy, you know? And I was like, I'm going to do, you know, I felt like I could do an essay book of like the stuff that's in my wheelhouse, you know, like the mm-hmm. pop culture stuff. And I was like, I could do that. That's no problem. I'll do a couple of those. And then once I'm, you know, established, I'll do this book about my dad. And that's my plan. Right. And so life don't work out like that, you know. And so I, you know, it's dad was getting old. You know, he's getting older. He's 81 now. And, you know, we want to get this stuff done. But also at the same time, it was a very fraught time. You know, this was, you know, Trump was president, you know, mm-hmm. it was like, this is urgent. And so this became the first book. And so I have no idea what's next. I probably, hopefully a nap at some point. That's probably thing I got going on next.
Man, this is going to sound like a question way off the base. But you know, you went to Davidson, you know, it's a big part of your bio. You rep Davidson a lot on social media. You clearly got the pride in the fighting. What are they, like owls? I don't even know what Davidson is, man.
Wildcats,
my bad. So yeah, I don't know why I said owls. So you're Davidson grad. What was it like to be an undergrad at Davidson and be armed with this history of your family and be just walking around a lot of just regular ass college students, and you're coming there you know, and let me be frank, like a predominantly white institution, you know, right. and you're there, the son of Dave Dennis. I mean, what was that experience like? I mean, did you feel like, okay, you know, these folks have something to learn from me? Did you feel like maybe I should transfer out of here? Like, what was college like for you?
So one of the beauties of being from Mississippi is, you know, we have this reputation, right, of like, you know, I don't want to go to Mississippi. It's so racist. It's, you know, the worst state in the country, blah, blah, blah. I have an immense amount of Mississippi pride, right? Because I've always had an understanding of what resistance movements have done in the state of Mississippi, right? Mm-hmm. And homegrown resistance movements. And I've always felt like when I go to these places, like I go to Davidson, and I did college trips. I went to Brown. You know, I went to Brown for the, you know, college tour thing and like really, you know, high institutions. I did a summer at Exeter and all this stuff. And I always felt like no matter what these folks think about me or think they can say to me, like they cannot compete, or they don't understand what kind of genius and brilliance and movement and organizing work that I come from. You know, so I always amongst folks with the confidence that, you know, underestimate or whatever, but like we come from stuff that you just can't mess with, you know. And so I think I carried myself like that. Now at Davidson, I also led this sort of rally when a bunch of racist stuff was happening to me my senior year. So we did some rebel rousing on there that I think Dad was pretty proud of. And I talked to him and he talked me through sort of that organizing work for that. So yeah, so those are some of the ways that I think, you know, I carried myself at Davidson and sort of the rest of my life.
Good God, that sounds like a story. So you're at Davidson, and you get advice from an absolute, you know, icon of the civil rights movement to deal with your stuff. That had to feel like having a, you know, like a ray gun in your back pocket showing up to a knife fight or something.
It was, you know, it was really, you know, my dad and my mom too, like both of them were always, I mean, young, when I was young, because I dealt with teachers who were terrible teachers in middle school and high school and probably, you know, anti-Black or racist teachers. And they were always like, we got your back. If, you know, if you're doing what you think is right, we got your back, you know. I remember when I was in seventh grade, a teacher pulled me into the hallway and told me she thought I was racist against white people, right? And both my parents showed up, but my mom showed up and like lit into it, right? And so like I always felt, you know, I was never scared to just do what I felt was right. And so at Davidson, there was a HBCU, Livingstone College, nearby where I pledged Phi Beta Sigma, and I had a bunch of friends, and they would come over and hang out. And long story short, one of the white frat houses we were trying to hang out, like called the cops on us and told us we were making the white folks uncomfortable. And so I wrote an article, and I had these shirts made, and we did this rally, and we did all this stuff. But I was calling Dad through the process because he is a community organizer. That is his gift, right? I cannot do that. I cannot organize people. I can't do this. So I was calling him to see, you know, think about the logistics, and also for him to just be like, you know, just do it. You know, do it and you'll be fine. And so that sort of, you know, belief and having that in my back pocket was sort of always something that, you know, was great to have from my childhood.
You know, that's to me probably one of the most moving parts of the book was actually early on, because I relate to it, but about your father sort of getting reinvigorated by Bob Moses to get back into the fray and being like, wow, these are the shoes in which I'm most comfortable, so to speak. And that's beautiful. Would you say that? I was wondering if you could just say something about that, about your dad's second life as an organizer. And would you say that outside of family, the most important person in your father's life was Bob Moses?
Yeah, I would think I would definitely say so. Bob, dad has said a lot of times that Bob Moses came back and saved his life. Well, he saved his life twice, essentially. He got him out of Baton Rouge and sort of got him into, voter registration work. And, he came back in the 90s. Dad had spent most of the time after he left the movement, 70s, 80s, just totally detached from the movement. Everybody sort of was like, it was like leaving war, Bob had gone to Africa and sort of detached from that. And Dad was sort of, in a sort of a mess, to be frank, like he was, just out of it. He was doing, doing drugs and trying to figure himself out and doing work that was really unfulfilling, like law work that was just, there was money, but it wasn't what he, what his passion was. And so when Bob came back and introduced him to this idea of the algebra project and math as the, sort of a new frontier for fighting for equality, and Dad got back into community organizing work, it really got him on the right path and sort of cleaned his life up and brought it, brought him into a new movement space.
That's amazing. And Bob Moses, such a giant, for sure. One last question for you. You've been really generous with your time, and the book is fantastic. The Movement Made Us, A Father, A Son, and the Legacy of a Freedom Ride. We always ask folks on this show when they do books, like what music they were listening to when they were putting it together. What music they were listening to when they were writing, what music maybe they were listening to when they were winding down after writing. And you in particular, I wanted to ask this because, your writing about music has been so prodigious. So can you tell us a little bit about the music that animated your work?
I was listening to, a whole lot of children's video game soundtracks, because a lot of this was written during the pandemic while my son was at virtual learning right next to me. So a lot of Disney songs that was part of the writing process. But I think there was a lot of Gil Scott-Heron that I was listening to. There was a lot of Big Crit, who is a rapper out of Mississippi. A lot of Isaiah Rashad, who is out of Nashville, who is, one of my favorite artists. And he was, doing a lot of, he does a lot of music about his relationship with his father also. So that was really a lot of the stuff. I was a lot of Southern hip hop, because I was trying to tap into that's I was writing this book really trying to make sure I tapped into that Southern pride, that pride that I was talking about earlier about being from Mississippi and changing stuff and getting stuff done and, being sort of pressed upon by white supremacy and fighting back even harder. So I was really trying to get into that South got something to say type of mentality, especially since I was writing a lot of the Mississippi parts, when being unable to travel to Mississippi, which was real tough.
Yeah, exactly. I know that feeling for sure. The pandemic writing process.
Yeah.
It was a challenging one. Well, you've been super generous with your time, David. I really do appreciate it. The book is The Movement Made Us, A Father, A Son, and the Legacy of a Freedom Ride. Before you go, any words on Winning Time, the Lakers show? And I wanted to get your 2 cents as to what you think of this project. Seeing on HBO.
I really want to get into the Winning Time stuff. It's like the last episode was a lot better. Here's my issue with Winning Time is that it feels really mean-spirited for no reason. It feels and especially compared to the Apatow other work and who they cover and Vice and all that stuff, like they have this sort of like lovable evil white guy thing to it, and these are like horrible people that those movies are about, right? And this is sort of like about the Lakers, right? So it's like, the Lakers have, and so a lot of the choices that they've made in terms of fictionalizing stuff just feels like only like mean-spirited, right? Like the worst of folks, right? And it bothers me because it's like Magic Johnson and Kareem are two very iconic black figures, right? Mm-hmm. And like, why are you making that choice, especially with them? Like, I understand, like, Magic Johnson's documentary did him no favors in this aspect. Like, it really sort of made, you know, especially we was talking about Cookie and stuff like that in their relationship and sort of how he laughs it off, really makes Winning Time a little bit more palatable, because it's like, oh, well, that's actually not so far from the truth. But I think up until, you know, this last episode, last couple episodes, they're really focused more on the game. I think Kareem and Magic were very just one-dimensional characters. You know, Magic was just a sex hound and a womanizer, and Kareem was just like this curmudgeon. And it didn't really give me a full appreciation of all the other stuff that made them who they are, which I feel a sort of way about a white guy doing that to two of those, you know, iconic figures. But again, like, the last couple episodes sort of did a little bit more character building than the earlier episodes. So I'm coming around to it a little bit more. It's entertaining for sure, but I'm not sure how necessary some of the changes they made were.
Who can we give props to? Quincy Isaiah and Solomon Hughes as Magic and Kareem?
Oh, they're fantastic. I mean, the acting is fantastic. You know,
yeah.
You know, Magic just jumps off the screen. Everybody's just being a great actor in the show. I mean, if it were just totally fictionalized show, I'd be like, this is just fantastic. This is like one of the best shows out. But I think the fact that they're taking so many liberties and doing all this stuff with it is bothering me. But the acting is just incredible.
No, that's very fair. It's I don't think the show has as much to use something I used earlier in the interview. I don't think it has as much protein as it thinks it does.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of cotton candy.
Uh huh.
But yeah. Man, as a show that's getting people through some crappy times.
Right.
That's something, if nothing else. But you're making some good points, man. I hear what you're saying about that. And the more Kareem, the better. You can't have too much Kareem for me. So right.
Yeah.
But, you know, David, really do appreciate your time, man. Thank you so much for being on the pod.
Oh, thank you, man.
This is terrific. I'm going to say the name of the book one more time so everybody gets it. The book is called The Movement Made Us, A Father, A Son, and the Legacy of a Freedom Ride. If you have any interest whatsoever in the history of the Black freedom struggle, we have a book that is now an indispensable part of its library. We'll be back right after this message from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. We'll be back right after this, but first, a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine. Okay, look, the need for independent journalism has never been more important, and The Nation brings it each and every week like they've been doing since 1865. I'm serious. This is what you gotta read. It's The Nation Magazine. Go to thenation.com/subscribe, and please never forget that when you support The Nation Magazine, you are also supporting the continued existence of this podcast. So please subscribe. Go to www.thenation.com/subscribe. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. And now I've got some choice words. Okay, look, for 2 months, the response of the sports world to basketball star Brittany Griner's disappearance and then jailing in a Russian prison for allegedly possessing hashish oil has been near silence. For 2 months, we heard that the State Department was going to handle it. For 2 months, we heard that we were going to let the Russian justice system run its course despite the shredded political amicability between the Putin regime and the United States. For 2 months, we heard from the WNBA that they were respecting the wishes of Griner's family and staying quiet. For 2 months, we've seen most of the sports world, which would have been holding daily candlelight vigils if Tom Brady was facing years in a Russian labor camp, seem blasé about the whole affair. For 2 months, people have been begging the league to stop telling its players not to comment, that we needed to raise up Griner's name and not stick our heads in the sand. For 2 months, the argument has been that without pressure, the U.S. government would have Griner's freedom low on its priority list. Now, with Griner's trial looming on May 19th, at long last, there has been a change in strategy. There's finally a modicum of hope. The freeing of Trevor Reed from a Russian prison camp, the incredible words written by Griner's wife, Sherelle, and the continual pressure by tenacious fans and grassroots media members has produced change. The State Department has reclassified Griner's case as one where a person has been wrongfully detained and is effectively being held as a political hostage. They have taken her case out of the consular's office, which was doing little more than trying to ensure that Griner was not being mistreated while behind bars. An important task, but not an avenue towards freedom. Then late on Monday, a State Department official emailed ESPN a statement that read, "The Department of State has determined that the Russian Federation has wrongly detained U.S. citizen Brittany Griner. With this determination, the Special Envoy for Hostage Affairs, Roger Karstens, will lead the interagency team for securing Brittany Griner's release." This is extremely significant. It means that the U.S. State Department has cast off the fear that raising up Griner's name would make her a political pawn in tense times. It means that Griner could be eligible for another prisoner swap, the same method that freed Trevor Reed. It means that the WNBA can stop pretending that Griner is the invisible hostage and do what they do so well, speak out, be heard, and use their cultural capital to propel Griner's case firmly into the public realm. It means that the rest of the sports world can be held to account for their silence. The weight of this should not exclusively be on the shoulders of WNBA players. The entire sports world, media, players, executives, needs to raise up her name and say, "Free Brittany Griner." The WNBA Players Union got a head start. Aneka Ogumike, the union's president, said in a statement posted to social media, "It has been 75 days that our friend, teammate, and sister, Brittany Griner, has been wrongfully detained in Russia. It is time for her to come home." Having learned that the U.S. government has now determined that BG is being wrongfully detained, we are hopeful that their efforts will be significant, swift, and successful. Then on Tuesday, the WNBA announced that it would keep Griner, quote, "at the forefront of what we do." There will be a decal with Griner's initials along with her number 42 on the home court of every WNBA team. And let me tell you, the NBA should at least do the same for the duration of the playoffs. But these desperately needed actions must be seen as a jumping off point, and that alone. In just 2 weeks, without swift intervention, Brittany Griner will be in a Russian courtroom facing 5 years in a labor camp and 10 years behind bars. We are getting a late start, and that is an outrage. But this is not the time to mourn that fact. It's time to do all we can to ensure that Brittany Griner, basketball icon and political prisoner, comes home.
We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it. But we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast.
And now it's time for the part of the show we call Just Stand Up and Just Sit Your Ass Down. The Just Stand Up Award Stand Up! Does go to the WNBA, not just for speaking out for Brittany Griner, which they started as their season went underway this past weekend, but also the fact that they have spoken out against the Supreme Court leak that aims to throw this country back into Neanderthal times, or at least the age of the Salem witch trials, and criminalize abortion and reproductive rights. Good for the WNBA issuing a statement about that. I expect we'll hear more from them in the future about this. And frankly, every athlete, whatever your gender may be, should be speaking out against this manifest injustice, because guess what? We've been saying this on this show. A lot of people are saying, oh, they're coming for abortion rights now. They're going to go for marriage equality next. They're going to go for this next. They're going to go for this next. And that ignores that they've already been going for stuff. Ask trans youth if things haven't already been started to roll back. Ask teachers. Ask librarians. Ask women in prison and what their reproductive rights look like. So these rights have already been taken away while a lot of people have not been noticing, And now people are waking up to this fact, and let's just hope they haven't boiled the frog already and that there still is the capacity for the kind of red-hot outrage that it's going to take to keep the barbarians at the gate. Another Just Stand Up award goes to J.J. Redick for this clip on ESPN's First Take.
It's because he plays with joy and fun and a carefree attitude and a fearlessness. You can't take away what makes a player great. So there's no shut up and play.
God, he is so polarizing. I can get for all the fans that you think listen to the podcast and watch them. I can give you 50 million fans who would tell you the same thing enough already. So he is a polarizing athlete. Sure, there are certain younger fans especially that like to hear him play. I'll give you a large segment of older fans who have followed the NBA for 60 years, who are, this is not a political scenario or a race situation, who have followed Wilt and grew up as a Knick fan, who loved Clyde and loved Reed and loved the Pearl.
I disagree with you on that. I'm not saying it's a race situation. I'm saying that the fans you're talking about, they talk about athletes that way, like you just talked about an athlete.
I think there's a lot.
Segment. The people on Fox News talk about athletes that way. My issue. I don't actually care about the fans that watched Bob Cousy play or watched Wilt play. I don't care. Right. I appreciate that they've been NBA fans that long.
Right.
But I don't appreciate the undertone.
Look, anybody who can shut up Chris Mad Dog Russo will always get a Just Stand Up award on this show. But the fact that J.J. Redick did it politically and the fact that J.J. Redick has become the most likable, politically on-point person at ESPN, despite being J.J. Redick. I mean, if you had told me this when he was at Duke, I would have said, no way, no how. But this guy, over the years, has proven himself to be an absolutely right-on-time individual. So, J.J. Redick, for putting the smackdown on Chris Mad Dog Russo and for making a political point that needed to be made, Just Stand Up award for you, buddy.
Stand up!
The Just Sit Down award this week.
Sit your ass down.
I mean, goes to Mike Vrabel, the whack ass coach of the Tennessee Titans. He's doing some rally with Donald Trump. And to do a rally with Donald Trump is disgusting anyway. To do a rally with Donald Trump is unforgivable anyway. But to do it as an NFL coach, given the way that Donald Trump has used NFL players as a racial punching bag for years, I mean, it is absolutely disgusting. It is wild to me that the stick to sports or the shut up and dribble, it never goes to white coaches, white owners. It never goes to people who, frankly, who are espousing right-wing politics. And that, to me, is why it always goes back to something, God, I've been saying as long as I've been doing this work, which is that when they say sports and politics don't mix, they're not really talking about sports and politics. They're talking about sports and a certain kind of politics, sports and resistance politics. When it comes to politics that oppress people, the sports world is only too happy to gather that into their ample arms. Mike Vrabel, for real, dude, just sit your ass down.
Sit your ass down.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thank you so much to our guest, David Dennis Jr. Thank you so much to David Tigaboo. A lot of Davids this week. Three of us all hanging out here on the podcast. David Tigaboo being the producer of the pod. Thanks for everybody out there for listening. Listen, if you like the show, help us grow the show. Tell a friend. Send a file. Do what you got to do. Last week's show about minor league baseball did great. And we want to keep up that momentum this week. So please help us out. Write a review, do this, do that. There's so many things you can do to help spread the word about a podcast, and ours should be at the top of your list. Come on, help us out. Wait, this all sounds way too desperate. So let me just wind it back and say, for everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.